Meeting Tom Cruise is a production of the Dan Patrick Podcast Network and iHeartRadio.
We have a story later to tell you that we have not met Tom Cruise, but we have made Tom Cruise laugh.
Whoa, whoa. Ooh, okay, let's stop. Let's hold off, though.
Hold stop.
Let's build some tension.
You got the big, handsome, toothy grin from Tom Cruise. Love it.
Tom Cruise is the greatest movie star of all time. He's the first actor to have six consecutive $100 million grossing films. He's shrouded in mystery, and yet to many is one of the nicest and hardest working people. We love Tom Cruise. We are inspired by Tom Cruise. And while we work in Hollywood, we've never actually met Tom Cruise. So we're going to talk to some people who have. We'll hear some great stories, and maybe, just maybe, one of them one day will lead us to the man himself so that we can have stories of our own. Our own stories of meeting Tom Cruise.
Boys, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to not find the knock list or the rabbit's foot, but rather listen to this whole podcast and get your Ethan Hunt fix on. Welcome back, folks, to a very special crossover edition of Meeting Tom Cruise. Like SVU joining forces with the cast of Chicago PD, we here at MTC, that's our nickname, let's make it a thing, are joining forces today with the fellas at Light the Fuse to talk all things Mission Impossible. But before I introduce them, let's say hi to my Benji Dunn. He's our Simon Pegg with much better hair. He's Joel Johnstone. Joel, listen, quick question.
Okay.
If the IMF were real, role do you think you would, like what would be your job at the IMF?
Printer fixer.
Just bottom of the rung.
Assistant printer fixer.
I feel like I would be that guy that, do you remember in those military movies where there's always the cool sniper and then there's the guy that sits behind the cool sniper that has to like be like, the wind is
little to the left.
Yeah. But then immediately when I say that, no, I wouldn't, because I'm ADD.
They'd be like, Jeff, get off your phone. Stop watching Air Force One. We're trying to take somebody out. Stop watching Air Force One.
It's so good. Dude, have you ever seen him play a Russian before? I mean, Oldman's just the best, even as a Russian. By the way, a lot of people die in Air Force One. On one plane, they murder a lot of people.
Big body count.
Count for one airplane. Okay, also with us is the guy who dies first in every action film. That's it. He's our producer, Alec Lev. Alec, like, really, I mean, just how fast do you die in a film? Like, if they cast you the way you look right now with the good shaved head, like, no matter how old you look, you still look like you're 24. Like, you're taken out quick, right?
Here's what happens. You hear a gunshot in black.
Okay.
The picture comes up and blood just splats against the wall.
Tarantino style. Yep.
Clunk. I'm that dead body.
Yeah. But not even facing up. Like, your body's kind of turned sideways. So you have to say to your family and friends, that's me. Can we just quickly talk about Tom Cruise having the best weekend ever? I don't know when we're releasing this, but it doesn't matter. Come on, you guys. How cool is it to be Tom Cruise?
I don't think I know what you're talking about.
I love that you don't, because Alec and I do, and you're going to love this. Joel, Tom Cruise started his day by being at the Wimbledon final to watch Novak Djokovic win his 20th Grand Slam.
Okay.
He sat, obviously, very close to the Queen's box. And he sat
to sit next to the Queen's box.
And right there next to the Queen's box. You know what I mean? And it's a big box, by the way.
That's Her Majesty. Watch your mouth.
Tom Cruise started his day by attending the men's singles final at Wimbledon, where he sat with Christopher McQuarrie and another actor from the movie next to him. They enjoyed a great four-setter where Djokovic won his 20th Grand Slam. And then, Alec, tell him where he went next.
He just strolled over. Skydanced right over to the Euro finals
at Wembley Stadium. Yeah. 80,000 people. And who did he sit with there, Alec? David Beckham.
No big deal.
He's just there with Beckham.
Really?
That's what he did in one day. You know who else did that? You know who's the other person that did that? The soon-to-be Queen of England.
I was just going to say the Queen. Yeah, that's it.
It was just Kate. I think we're not sure. Alec and I were discussing. We're not sure if Kate's husband. Oh, my God. I'm forgetting his name. What's his name?
Barry.
Ted. We're not sure if Ted made it. Oh, my God. Why can't we think of his name?
William.
It's Prince Bobby and Paulie. Get over here.
Oh, boy. Tommy with a great weekend. All right, guys. Light the Fuse, a fantastic podcast where they talk about nothing else but the Mission Impossible series, which we can all agree is probably the greatest series of all time. Alec might say Star Wars, but I'm thinking by, you know, all said and done in another 20 years, just like Djokovic taking over Federer and Nadal. That's what's going to happen here is Mission Impossible is going to become the greatest series of all time. We got Drew Taylor, who's a film journalist, Charles Hood, who's a writer director. They've done over 200 episodes. They've talked to some of the biggest names in the series, and we should get right to it.
My name is Alec Levin. I'm the producer of Meeting Tom Cruise. And today we've got a great crossover episode on these two podcasts here. Seated digitally before me are four hosts with two podcasts. So we're just going to go around the room to start out to introduce everyone, who you are, what's your show, whatever you want to say about yourself. And then we'll get this. We'll get the party started.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jeff Meacham. My co-host here with me is Joel Johnstone. We're from the Meeting Tom Cruise podcast. We live in Los Angeles. We've been in actors in Hollywood for a long time. But guess what? We're in love with Tom Cruise. We think he's the greatest movie star of all time, but we've never met Tom Cruise. So what we do is speak to people that have met Tom Cruise or can help us get closer to Tom Cruise. And today, we're here with another couple of guys from another podcast that are going to help us get closer. Right, Joel?
I mean, they say misery loves company, but psychotic obsession also loves
company. Yeah, totally.
I'm Joel Johnstone.
5'7".
Also actor. If I'm 5'7", beautiful, majestic blue eyes. I've known Jeff Meacham for over 20 years now. We met in the summer of 99 in Oxford, England, and it was love at first sight. We began talking about Tom Cruise that summer because Eyes Wide Shut came mm-hmm. out. That was the talk of the town. And we have bonded over our love of Tommy ever since, and that's all you need to know about me.
That's right.
Hello. Yes. Hi, I'm Charles Hood. I'm a co-host of Light the Fuse. We talk about Mission Impossible, the whole franchise. We have different people. We've had many people on the show who give us great Tom Cruise stories. I guess we're hoping someday to meet Tom Cruise as well. It's Drew and I actually also met in 1999.
No way.
That we met in high school. And he had moved from Texas. I'm originally from Nebraska. We both went to high school in Connecticut, and that's where we met. And I'm a filmmaker, a director. I have a movie called Night Owls that came out about 5 years ago that's on Amazon Prime. And it's also on, I think, Tubi and Canopy. And then I also did a movie for Hulu called A Nasty Piece of Work, which is part of the Blumhouse Into the Dark series.
Nice, dude.
And I'm Charles's co-host. My name is Drew Taylor, and I'm an entertainment journalist. And we've been doing this podcast for so long. How long have you guys been doing this podcast?
Well, we've only been doing it for, what, a year? Not even. No, not
a year.
Has it been a year?
Yeah. Not even. Yeah, no, we found out this was going to be a thing last August.
Yeah, last summer. So it really has not been going on that long. But wait a minute. Let me ask you this question. We always start our podcast by asking our guests, tell me about their lives leading up to the moment that they met Tom Cruise. But for you guys, the moment you started Light the Fuse, where did that happen? Where did that start, the idea of Light the Fuse?
Well, it really started, I think, when we saw Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol together.
That's at least when the obsession started.
Sure.
That's where the obsession started. And yeah, then it just became like near daily text messages about, did you see the trailer? What are they going to do in the next one? You know,
right.
That moment, seeing it in the IMAX at Lincoln Center, which is one of the great IMAX theaters, I think, in the world.
Yes.
Was really amazing. And Charles and I were by far the most vocal participants of the 2 p.m. screening Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol that we saw. And then later that day, we went to a thing at Lincoln Center that Brad Bird was doing, and we got to chat with him, and it was like, okay, this is like, we are obsessed with this movie. And then a few years later, we started this and had no idea where it was going to go. But we have a story later to tell you that we have not met Tom Cruise, but we have made Tom Cruise laugh.
Whoa. Okay, let's hold off, though. Let's build some tension. Okay. Let's build some tension.
You got the big, handsome, toothy grin from Tom Cruise. Love it.
I cannot imagine seeing in IMAX Ghost Protocol and seeing that sequence when the camera goes out over the Burj Khalifa and does that wind sound. I'm already pretty afraid of heights, so that must have just...
In my memory, I remember us both kind of like leaning forward like we were, you know, that's how immersive that was.
So Drew and Charles, your guest list is quite something. And if people don't know, you guys have spoken to a man named Chris McQuarrie. And you've spoken to another man very recently named Brian De Palma. I guess our question is, what's their phone number? / how the hell? How did you connect with these folks?
Let's bring them in. Charles, let's...
And here's Brian De Palma.
He's your dad?
That's not fair.
Yeah, we've been very lucky to talk to many, many people associated with the franchise. Three of the five directors that have made these movies.
Who are you missing?
We're missing John Woo, which we've sort of given up on, but I don't think is completely outside of the realm of possibility. And then J.J. Abrams, who did not return our email, but that's fine.
Didn't return it yet.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
We just got to get the right opportunity. It'll come. Something will come up.
We agree.
If he's listening to this, he can
I'm waiting for the guest. I'm waiting for the guest that we have that's like, oh, wait, do you guys just want to meet him? I'll call him right now. He'll do it.
So I wanted to ask other questions and beat around the bush and make this something a little bit deeper, but I'm not a deep person. Joel knows that. Alec definitely knows that.
Really not, Jesus.
Have you guys yet on your pod done the ultimate ranking? And do you have a favorite Mission Impossible and a least favorite?
Well, I think our rankings change, but I think they've settled into a similar ranking, which Charles can recite right now, I think.
Yeah, I think Drew and I have an identical ranking. I think it has settled.
Obviously, Mission Impossible 2 is the first.
That is our number six.
Okay, that's easy. I think we can all agree upon that, right? Like, that's just simply agreed upon. I do want to talk about Mission Impossible 2 in a little bit, though, at the same time. Okay, keep going.
Yeah, there's some good stuff in that movie.
Yeah, there's some fun stuff, man, especially with fire in the eyes of Duray Scott. It's maybe my favorite moment of all time, when there's literally fire in his eyes.
Oh, that's right!
Our number five would be MI3.
Okay.
And then our number four would be Rogue Nation.
Wow!
And then three would be Ghost Protocol. Two would be Fallout.
What?
And then number one would be Brian De Palma.
Wow.
I love you. You guys are purists. I love you guys. I love you guys.
I'm just going to write off the bat, say I wildly disagree.
Well, that's the great thing is that there's so many great entries in the series that people have wildly different lists. And the thing that I love about Mission Impossible fans is that they're so cordial with each other. It's not like other fan bases where they're like at each other's throats and it's like toxic. But everybody's like, oh, yeah, I like that one. And I like this one. And there's no real fight happening.
I'm pretty sure we can all agree that the most toxic relationship has to be Star Wars, right? It has to be.
Like, Star Wars and whatever is going on in the DC. Oh, yeah. Universe.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
All right, Jeff, so count them down. Don't leave us hanging. Or just forget about it because I don't really care.
Well, I want to know where your list deviates.
My list deviates immediately at number five. Your number five is my number one. I think Mission Impossible 3 is the best one of the franchise. I think the characters are the best. I think it's the one that was the one to me that started it all. Do you know what I mean? One is nothing like 3 through 6. Two is nothing like 3 through 6. Three, the J.J. Abrams one, is what started the, you know, Ethan Hunt would die and do these unbelievable risks. He's not a superhero like John Woo tried to make him out to be. And I think it's the best bad guy ever in Philip Seymour Hoffman. The best opening sequence that is just pure acting.
Can I jump in with that opening? That is hands down the best opening of the six movies.
That countdown.
Maybe my favorite opening of any action movie.
Have you guys ever seen a show called Alias? Because there were about 25 episodes of Alias that began exactly like that.
No shit. See, I didn't see it. And maybe that's the problem.
Me neither.
Oh, yeah. And then we even found a recent creative screenwriting article where basically JJ and Bob Orsi and Alex Kurtzman basically said, yeah, we had a bunch of ideas left over from Alias episodes and we kind of stapled them all together and put them into a movie. So it was like,
it wasn't that blatant of a quote, but it was.
Yeah.
They just erased Jennifer Gardner's name on a storyboard and just kind of like write
maybe,
in.
Maybe that's where sort of my jadedness for 3 comes from is having watched Alias for however many years and then seeing a movie that was full of close-ups on actors in a $200 million movie and an opening sequence that starts mid-action sequence and then goes back a few days, which was a frequent trope of Alias. But please continue. I'm sorry to interrupt your ranking.
No.
You're totally wrong, but please continue.
But I love hearing that. That would make sense. That would absolutely dilute my movie-going experience if I had watched Alias.
That's incredibly informative, Drew. Thank you.
We are not used to learning things.
Oh, yeah.
On our podcast.
No. Like, everything you said was so smart.
Alex Alex a little open to it. Alex a little open to it. Jeff and I, we don't want to learn anything.
Yeah.
You lost me, Drew. I read. You just said, I read. And then I was like, yeah.
Jeff and I like the movies that we like. And all we want to do is just rewatch those movies. We don't want to watch anything new. Just those movies over and over.
I'm a firm believer in rewatching stuff. I think it's important to rewatch your favorite stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Understand why you love it so much.
Yeah.
If Crimson Tide is on TBS later today, I will watch the whole thing with the commercials.
Immediately. Just immediately. We watched The Fugitive just to put ourselves to sleep. Netflix has destroyed my relationship with my wife. Right now, just last night, I finished watching Air Force One and then immediately went into Midnight Run instead of going to bed.
I will do a Midnight Run podcast with anyone any day, please.
Yeah, I love, that's one of my favorite movies.
So Jeff, your list, my God, this is another thing that we like to do is take about 47 minutes to get through a list of five names.
And this is the problem. Alec asks us to be funny all the time, but then at the same time, he wants us to just keep moving along all the time instead of enjoying our lives.
No, I just ask you to be done.
Mute yourself. Guys, I'm going to go controversial on my next one as well. So three, I moved all the way to my number one. My number five is the first Mission Impossible.
You're insane. You're insane.
Joel, it is my time. It is my time, young man. I know that it's the original. I know how I felt when I saw it. So I should put it higher on the list. But because I love 4 through 6 so much, I just can't. And then when I went back and watched the first one again, I was like, I like Rogue Nation and, you know, and Fallout and all of them so much better and Ghost Protocol. So it's so hard for me. So I have to put it. Is that just sacrilege, Charles? Is that
no,
like,
we found people that have disliked the first one quite a bit.
Yeah. Why am I wrong, though? Like, why is it so remote?
Well, you're wrong because the filmmaking is so outstanding. I mean, it is so insanely well done. The ILM effects are incredible. This was a creation of a character that had never entered this franchise before. Nobody knew it was going to work, and they knocked it out of the park. I mean, I just, Danny Elfman's score, we both are
so
obsessed
good.
With.
And I think the Langley sequence in the middle, right? The Langley sequence is the set piece of the franchise that
you're right.
is still yes. referenced in movies and TV shows to this day.
It's the cover of our podcast.
It's our logo. I mean,
yeah, there you go. Like, it is so iconic, and it's one of them. I've like realized recently, like, it is really one of the most iconic images in movie history.
Yeah,
because it's still being referenced every day. It's crazy.
I'm revisiting a story I've told in our podcast, but it's my favorite. It will not be replaced as my favorite movie going moment when he drops down from the ceiling. It was the only time I've ever heard a theater so quiet. It was packed. It was opening weekend when I saw it, and I looked around and nobody moved. Nobody ate a piece of candy. Nobody had their finger in a bag. Like, it was just like, you know, like it was just, everyone was invested in the same moment together with the same intensity. It was amazing.
It's 9 minutes. It's 9 minutes of silence, basically. Like, Ving Rhames, like, whispers a few words, but other than that, it's just silence for 9 minutes.
And Ving Rhames' tension is so good in it too. Even being in the room, like, he creates unbelievable tension. All right.
We went to, there was a 25th anniversary screening in May that we went to at the AMC City Walk, and there were people in the audience. I think there might have been a couple people who had never seen the movie before.
Really?
And the part where at the end of the whole sequence, the Langley sequence, like, you know, Jean Reno gets the disc from Ethan and he accidentally drops his knife and the knife just goes in super slow-mo down, and people were just gasping.
That is
like,
cool.
Still, 25 years later in the theater, it was awesome.
Also insane to say 25 years, a quarter of a century old. Like, that's, I don't know what bothers me more, that it just is that old or the 90s were that long ago. Like, that's...
Isn't that bananas? Yeah.
All right. I hear you, but I will say this much. If you were to ask me right now, and I haven't watched the movies in a while, if I could tell you the plot of all the movies, the one I do forget the most is Rogue Nation. Why is that? Is that a confusing plot, or am I just...
Oh, yes. I still cannot make heads or tails of Rogue Nation.
Right. I know it's good.
It's good, yeah, but it's... the details of the plot are somehow the least consequential of any of the movies, and the most confounding as well. I mean, I think that Rogue Nation was kind of...
Drew's been harping on this one for a while.
Yeah. This is a runner of our of our podcast.
Rogue Nation is the underwater sequence, right?
I think in a lot of ways, like, Christopher McQuarrie was kind of figuring things out on that one, and he fully admits too that they were kind of coasting off the goodwill of Ghost Protocol, and sort of as a Ghost Protocol sequel too, it doesn't quite work either.
I don't have the same hang-ups on the plot of Rogue Nation. I think to me the my top four are like on a are like heads and shoulders above MI3 and MI2. So like even though Rogue Nation is my number four, I think it's pretty. It's not far behind Ghost Protocol in my
wow.
list.
Wow,
like it's really really good. And it is a little convoluted, but I don't. It doesn't. By the end of the movie, it all wraps up in a way that like I was able to follow what's happening and you know it. If you asked me to try to sit here and explain what happened in the movie, it would probably take me a few minutes to gather my thoughts and make that happen. But I think I could do it.
I don't believe him.
And now, commercials.
Wait, but let me... Okay, so hold on, because now I got to go back to MI3. But don't... So do you guys like J.J. Abrams' movies, though?
Sure, yeah. I mean, we're big fans of Star Trek. 2009 for sure.
The first Star Trek is wonderful. I think that movie's fantastic.
So good, right? Yeah, that opening again, another opening sequence that yeah. just
there are decisions that undercut all the good stuff about three. Like, okay, you have Dan Mendel, amazing cinematographer, did some really incredible stuff with Tony Scott around the same time. Shoots the movie almost exclusively in close-ups where the actor's face is so big it takes up, you know, it goes beyond the frame of the film.
Yeah, Drew, but that actor's face is Tom Cruise.
But then it's also like Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. Don't need to ever be that close to that dude.
He's pretty handsome. But I get you.
The other thing is like the Philip Seymour Hoffman thing Charles and I are always very sort of confused by. Because yes, he is great. And he's obviously an amazing actor and we miss him terribly. He doesn't get to do that much in the movie. He's only on screen for about 10 minutes. He shouts. We don't really know what his objectives are. We don't really know what the rabbit's foot is.
Yeah, that's the mystery. That's the beauty of the rabbit's foot. No, I loved... Oh, you're like, I can already tell, Drew, you come from a filmmaker's point of view, which is something I literally don't do at all. So I get that.
Drew, you've actually done your research. Jeff and I just have opinions based on nothing, just because we have opinions.
Well, I mean, but the fun thing is that Charles and I always talk about the most fun that Philip Seymour Hoffman has is when he's playing Tom Cruise playing Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh. Like
the Vatican sequence is so
yes.
great. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, the whole Vatican sequence.
When they open, the Vatican is the best. When they open up the manhole and you just go, what does he say? Yeah. He's like, what's up? He's like, nothing. What's up with you?
And they actually went there and shot that. You cannot feel like the Vatican is an incredibly isolated, private place. You like the outside public. They had to jump through so many hoops to go and film there.
Wait, they really did shoot inside the Vatican? Are you sure?
Charles, you want to tell the funny story about?
Well, there are a few. They filmed a little bit at the Vatican. They also filmed at this place outside of Rome. I think it's called Caserta or something like that. So they had another place that stood in for the Vatican a bit. But there is a story about in order to shoot the Jonathan Rhys-Meyers driving up in the van and getting out in front of the Vatican, they had a fake shoot where they had nuns and girls in bikinis to attract the tourists away from where they were doing the actual shooting of Jonathan Rhys-Meyers driving up in a van.
What?
Okay, wait. Let's back this train up. Nuns and girls in bikinis? Or
were the nuns in bikinis?
It was like a fake music video or something. I don't know what the fake project was purporting to be.
You really had my mind spinning there quite a
bit.
That's
genius.
That was I know Maggie Q crashed the Lamborghini or whatever the car she was driving.
No, she didn't.
She didn't have a license, so that was the first time she was ever driving. But I think that might have been... I don't think they shot that car at the Vatican. I think they might have shot that at the place that was standing in for the Vatican.
Okay.
But she like, you know, it wasn't like she wrecked it, but she just, you know, she ran into another car.
All right. Well, I guess my biggest thing, and I will take this from an actor's point of view, to me, the tension that all the actors in that movie create from, you know, Lawrence Fishburne's character to, I mean, I love the lip reading sequence too. I love the pendulum sequence. You know what? They infuse sense of humor too into the franchise at that point when there was literally none in two and maybe a dash in one. But again, the only thing that I can make my argument about is that the franchise that we love, in my opinion, started at three. The Ethan Hunt that is in one and two has nothing to do with the Ethan Hunt that's in 3, 4, 5, 6. Do you agree or disagree with that? Do you think the one and one is similar?
No, I mean, but he did get to a place where he was in three. I think there is an evolution of the character through three. And I think Charles and I always like to bring up that they had no idea that the sort of bad robot version of these movies was actually going to start with three. I mean, they were so self-contained, the other ones. And I would argue even that Ghost Protocol is wildly different than three.
Right.
Due to the sensibilities of Brad Bird and his kind of...
Yes.
his interest in comedy, his sort of exaggerated sense of action and suspense.
Yeah, I mean, talking about humor, Ghost Protocol is the one that really, really brings in the humor.
It does, yeah.
Because 3 is still pretty grim.
Did Simon Pegg enter with Ghost Protocol, or did he not come until Fallout?
He's in 3. He introduced the rabbit's foot in 3. He's the one that tells the story.
Right.
Where he's
right,
like...
Right. Okay, yes, so he's been...
But there is a lot of humor in 3. Jonathan Rhys-Meyers' character creates a ton of humor in it. Like, he's always got the little, like... You know what? They're all bitter at their jobs. Do you remember that? That's the thing that they're all like... They're all like, he's like, all I do is copy, and all that kind of stuff. Like, they're all a little... And you get the wife character right. For the first time.
We like that there were actual sort of comedic conceits that were guiding 4, though. I mean, one, that everything breaks is such a wonderful mm-hmm. thing. And the other thing that they really added in 4 that has mercifully continued is Ethan screwing up and how funny that can be.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I think they finally got the character, like, and how to put Ethan in those situations.
You're absolutely right. That's right. I forgot it started with the Russian prison.
Remind me what... Because my mind is where does he first screw up?
Well, everything breaks in 4.
You were Drew. I heard you talk about this on the podcast. Who was it? I can't remember who it was who said, "I want to do a Mission Impossible where everything goes wrong." Where did that come from?
That came from Brad Bird. I mean, I think that was one of the tenets that he sort of set out when he was approached by Cruise.
Right, everything does break.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right. The gloves break.
When he gets the
phone call, that thing doesn't work. The self destruct.
Yeah,
doesn't
putting
work.
The
right.
You know they get caught by the camera in the hallway of the Kremlin.
Yes.
You know, obviously, the Kremlin exploding was never supposed to happen. Yeah. Yeah.
They have to do the whole thing without masks as the mask maker breaks.
Right. Yep.
Jeff, did you finish your list?
No, but the next 3, it doesn't matter because the next 3 to me are kind of interchangeable. That's my problem with the next 3 also, is that I love 4, 5, and 6.
Well, I mean, there are people who pick Rogue Nation as their favorite as well.
A lot of people.
I think a big reason for that is Rebecca Ferguson.
Right.
I mean,
right.
She is so fucking good at
that
movie.
Oh, right. Now it's coming back to me. Now you got the Opera House in Austria, which is a great sequence. That's right.
The whole Ilsa character is just wonderful.
Who found her for... I'm like, I know she was a star already in Europe, but like she American audiences were somewhat new to her. With the Mission Impossible franchise, who is responsible for putting her on the map?
Well, she was sort of a last minute replacement for a bigger name star who
Do
didn't
we know
work
who?
Out, and we are not at liberty to say who that is, sadly, on this podcast. So yeah, it was a little bit of a mad scramble, and they came across her, and what did McQuarrie say, Charles, when he found her?
I think they said she's Ingrid Bergman.
Yeah.
Oh my God! Absolutely,
yes,
absolutely.
Which, you know, Ilsa, the character name Ilsa, comes from Casablanca.
Oh my God! Right.
That is very cool. Charles, go back. Give me your Philip Seymour Hoffman. Come on.
This is a little convoluted. My journey with MI3 has been because the other reason why I was hesitant to love MI3 is something that I love about the first movie is that it adheres to Bruce Geller's credo for the original TV show. Bruce Geller was the creator of Mission Impossible, and he always had the writers not go into their personal lives. And I feel like in the first Mission Impossible movie, they do just enough where, you know, Ethan has the motivation because Kittredge gets his mom and his uncle in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So he can be mad and he can be pulled into somewhat of a, you know, there's a personal reason to be there, but he's not running into the arms of his mom and his uncle at the end of the movie. And
right.
It still keeps up that tradition of what Bruce Geller intended for the old TV show, because in the old show, sometimes the writers would try to bring in the personal backstories of the IMF agents, and Bruce would be like, no, that's not happening. We're not doing that. That's not what this is. So I was a purist that way, and that's what I really appreciated about the first Mission Impossible, and I thought Ghost Protocol did a really good job, just enough of his personal life. And then Fallout happened, and Fallout blew me away. So we started the podcast just a couple months before Fallout came out, and then it was like a build up to Fallout coming out, and then we've kind of just kept going. We never expected that to happen, but Fallout blew us away, and the way that Fallout brings back the Julia story from MI3 and gives it this satisfying conclusion,
yes,
I think makes MI3 better now in hindsight. When I go back and watch it now, I care more about this story that I didn't really care that much about when I first watched it.
Interesting.
So that's sort of my journey with MI3 and the whole personal story stuff. And now McQuarrie did it so well, and I was so emotionally pulled in. And it's also, that's the thing with Fallout, I never felt like it was too much. Like, they have those dream sequences, and, you know, and then the third act, like, you know, brings Julia in, but it doesn't ever feel like it's bogged down. And also, they use Julia in a really nice way She's helping the team.
I love that she's happy and there's no there's no sexual tension. They do a great job not giving us that kind of what I would call bullshit in that situation. Like, oh, don't do that.
And then, like, the other thing about three is, like, at the end, she's, like, suddenly picking up a gun. Ethan's knocked out and she's killing everybody. And I'm like, where's the rest of the IMF team? They got knocked. They left China before the third act. So it's like there's no IMF team in the third act other than he calls Simon Pegg, which is nice. But, you know, the movie ends with Ethan's girlfriend shooting all the bad guys. And she's never fired a gun before. She's like a, you know, a health professional. And it's just like, and then
wait a minute. Are you telling me you don't believe the idea that someone could be shocked back to life by ripping a wire out of a wall and then using that as a defibrillator?
No, I actually do like we enjoy the moments when Ethan dies for several minutes. He dies in both three and in Rogue Nation for several minutes and then comes back. It's one of Ethan's special skills that we talk about.
It's not just Ethan. It's Tom Cruise. Jeff, do you want to, do you remember the list?
I do almost. You guys, Charles Drew. We believe there have been 8 films, I'm just doing this off the top of my head, where Tom Cruise has died and come back to life.
Total flatline.
I mean, obviously, Edge of Tomorrow, that's the whole plot.
Yep.
Right.
Night and Day, is that one?
He definitely, he's undead and dead, obviously, in Interview with a Vampire, because he's a vampire.
That's true.
Right. Okay.
He dies.
Oh, wait, are right about Night and Day. You are, yes, because he's in the seat at the end. Yeah.
He dies in Oblivion. That's the whole thing of his character in Oblivion, is that his character has been killed, and he comes back. Alec, am I missing what?
Vanilla Sky.
Vanilla Sky.
The whole thing is based around that. The
turn of the entire, the twist of the entire movie is that he has died and been brought back to life.
Far and away, he's dead. The credits almost start and they have to like push the credits down to the bottom of the screen. Like they're the cameras come up to the sky and then like, nope, psych. And they come back down.
The mummy, he wakes up in a morgue after a plane explodes.
The mummy, he literally dies.
The sexiest corpse you've ever seen in the mummy.
Oh, he is.
God.
God, does that movie take a tailspin as just like in that sequence, too.
Terrible.
Boy, oh boy. So, yeah, I think we just named them all. Very good, Alec, on the mummy. Yeah, he has died in a lot of movies and come back to life.
So, hold on. Sorry. Yeah, let me finish my convoluted thing. So, another thesis that we had going into Fallout, that we feel like once we saw Fallout, it actually solved this problem, is that all of the Mission Impossible movies have kind of smaller, they like are sort of pyramid-shaped, and the midpoint has the best action sequence, and then the finale is kind of disappointing in a lot of the Mission Impossible movies.
4 is definitely like that. You don't really care about that car sequence. The carport sequence is surely not the
best.
Right,
as much as you do Dubai. And like, you know, there's some charm to it, but I think, you know, McQuarrie solved that in Fallout, and then the finale of Fallout is like, he's got the whole team working together.
Amazing.
And it's this huge, epic, amazing sequence with the helicopters, and it's fucking mind-blowing.
Yeah.
But then I think especially with MI3 and in relation to Philip Seymour Hoffman, he's barely in the climax because they bring in this other villain, and it's just like he gets into like a small little fist fight with Tom Cruise and then just gets hit by a truck, and that's the end.
Which is a really good sequence.
That's going back to what Drew was saying, like he's not really in the movie that much. And like, yes, he's great in the scenes that he's in, but I wish there was more for him to do.
We've also found out through doing almost 200 episodes that there were probably some physical limitations that Philip Seymour Hoffman had that maybe kept him from, you know, hanging off of a helicopter or something in the third act.
You're telling me he can't run a 440 the same way Tommy can?
Toe to toe, I think he would lag, is what I'm telling you. Yeah.
We'll never know. I disagree, and we'll never know it.
That's a problem that they actually have in a lot of action movies. And the first one that comes to my mind is Quantum of Solace, when he has to fight. He has just kicked everybody's ass. And then that's because remember, a lot of the bad guys in these movies are always very strange looking, talented actors that are probably from some like Nordic country.
Right.
And they're little guys and they have weird faces and amazing voices. Right. Like that is the talent of a lot of these bad guys. But then to get them to fight the main bad guy, you're like, wait a minute. So they always have to create a little moment where somehow they get the upper edge. And that happens in Quantum of Solace. Whatever that bad guy is in that whole movie, when he fights him at the end, you're like, no, James Bond can fucking destroy this guy with his pinky.
That dude who's 100 pounds sopping wet.
Yeah.
Who has
literally not worked out a day in his life, you know?
Also, John Wick, and I know our friends here made some spinoff episodes, Light the Wick, which I assume you made just because you came up with that title.
Yeah, did the title come first or the idea? Because it's genius.
We felt that the John Wick franchise was sort of spiritually similar to Mission Impossible in the sense that it is anchored by a single very charismatic actor who performs many of his own stunts with an emphasis on practical action and that kind of old-school filmmaking. So we thought there was a lot of fun crossover there. You can tell us if we're wrong.
With them, they have the opposite problem with the bad guys, where, like, those guys with the swords in the big glass...
There's no way John Wick lives.
The big glass fight. Like,
no way.
Clearly, they would murder Keanu Reeves in the face 100 times.
5 points. The last guy he fights in John Wick 3... There, that actually took me out of it. I was like, that's impossible. His lactic acid has built up at this point. He can barely lift his shoulders. There's no way he's beating this guy.
Well, the crazy thing about John Wick, too, is that those three movies take place over the course of like 1 week.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like, not only is it like it's Keanu Reeves against those amazing, you know, extremely skilled fighters. He's also been fighting nonstop for a week through three movies. He's pretty tired, I would guess.
Dude, I took a month off because I just went on vacation, got fat, and just came back to my personal trainer. I did deadlifts today. I can't sit on a toilet. Like, you're telling me that John Wick can make it through? It's ridiculous.
I want to plug another miniseries we're going to do, because we're going to do Top Gun Maverick. And when that movie comes out, assuming it goes well, we are going to hopefully do it. But the reason why I want to bring it up is because it's another terrible pun. So that's why I wanted to bring it up. It's Light the Fuselage.
Oh, you guys are good.
Love it.
You guys are good. That's I would have just been like, Light the Maverick? I don't know.
Hey, Jeff, thanks for asking about our lists.
Joel, it's your time, buddy. Your time. Go ahead. You have a list?
Oh, now that we're out of time? Thanks,
Jeff.
We're
not out of time. Are we out of time?
Thank you.
We're fine. Joel, I'm sorry. Joel, do you have anything that's shocking about your list?
Oh, my God. Thank you, Jeff. I had no idea you would ask. That's such a surprise. In fact, I do.
Here we go.
Obviously, two's at the bottom. Two's one of the worst. I'm going to put Legend and MI2 as like the black stains on Tom Cruise's otherwise impeccable resume. So two's at the bottom. Now, I'm going to say my 2 through 5, I could interchange any given day. Today, I'm going to say Ghost Protocol is number 5. Mm-hmm. Then I'm going to say...
Jesus he has not Christ. Worked hard on this list, boys. Not gonna lie. This is why we're sorry we saved
Jesus
him for last.
Christ. I apologize, guys.
Ghost Protocol.
You said Ghost Protocol already. That's not
yeah, no. But
it can't be also 4.
What am I thinking? No. In my mind, I can only think of 5 right now. I'm going to say number 7, even though I haven't seen it yet, is number 4.
7 and 8 is my number 1.
Never mind.
Look, my top 3, let me just get to my top 3. Fallout,
please.
Number 3. Mission Impossible 3 is my number 2. Mission Impossible 1 is my number 1.
There you go. All right.
Good man, Joel.
That's cool.
Good man.
Guys are ridiculous.
Although this Ghost Protocol being at the bottom is pretty egregious.
I know. I agree.
I liked... what am I... what's number 5 called?
Rogue Nation.
Rogue Nation. I like Rogue Nation better than Ghost Protocol. How did I do? Did I ace it? Why don't we... guys, when we edit this, let's all start with mine.
there's no wrong answer. That's the thing. They've got 6, at the very least, solid entries. Even MI2's got some really cool stuff in it.
Well, here's the thing. Rogue Nation does not have the Burj sequence. Charles and I always just talk about how the Burj Khalifa sequence is just the most amazing... thing. I mean, besides the kind of the Langley sequence in the first one is maybe the highlight in terms of set pieces.
Agreed.
Of the entire franchise.
I think even McCorry said in our first interview with him, he brought it up and said like he was mad at Brad for being able to do that sequence because he wishes he could have done it. Because that's just, well, like, how do you get better than the tallest building in the world?
You attach yourself to a plane and you put contacts that are... bulletproof in your eyes, and you hang the most expensive movie star on the planet off the fucking plane.
Well, the thing about the plane, I would argue, is the plane is a scene, and the Burj is a sequence. It is it is its own, you know, it's got its own hills and valleys and emotional contour. I mean, that sequence is really amazing.
Yeah, everything about it, like through, there's the, you know, the part where they're doing the con on both floors of the, you know, and they do the shot that goes through the floor. And there's also the foot chase through the sandstorm. I mean, the whole Dubai sequence is just.
Drew and Charles, can I ask a question? Jeff, this is a good question.
All right.
This is about Tom Cruise.
All right.
Okay.
Jesus.
Here we go.
We've learned a lot, we feel, about Tom Cruise by talking to people who not only have worked with him, but truly love him and have really incredible things to say. I'm wondering, what have you learned about Tom Cruise as a producer, as an actor, that was surprising to you through these 200 episodes? Is that okay, Jeff? Was that all right?
I actually like that question.
Thank you. Jesus.
I think our big takeaway, and Charles can jump in if I'm wrong, is that his commitment to kind of like excellence causes every single person on the crew, no matter what department they're in, to try to elevate their game to match yep. his enthusiasm and his commitment and dedication and sort of expertise. We recently heard this story, Charles, I forget who told it, about, you know, there was somebody hanging off of something. And so Cruz said, I need to have a set of stairs made. And in like 45 minutes, there were stairs that these guys had just put together to try to, you know, facilitate.
And it wasn't even a film set. He was just out at a cafe and somebody was hanging off a building. He goes, I got to save that guy. Somebody build me some stairs.
I imagine he takes that passion everywhere he goes. So, yeah, maybe.
Benito Martinez told us that at one point into a sequence, he was just kind of looking up in the sky and he was like, you know what we need? Let's get another plane to fly by.
Yeah.
Let's just get
yeah.
He went over to Doug Liman and he was like, let's just get another giant plane to fly by.
And they were flying that day. And that so day. Like, you can't just get a plane. You have to create a flight pattern and like get another pilot and all this, you know, and like 10 assistants were like, okay, you know, scrambling to find another plane and a pilot and a flight, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I heard a story before I started the podcast. I was doing a thing for The Mummy in New York and Jake Johnson told me about how he had this, you know, special workout room set up for that, probably that nude scene when he wakes up from the dead. And, you know, he and Jake Johnson were working out on it and it was a circuit, you know, and
Jake Johnson got jacked for that movie.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so they both started at the same point. And, you know, a few stations down, Cruz is like waiting for Jake Johnson to hurry up because he's already lapped him, you know, on this circuit of workout machines. So,
and he's got what, 20, 25 years on Jake Johnson?
Oh, easy.
Oh, yeah, easily.
Yeah, I think he'll be over 60 when the next, when Seven comes out.
So. He just turned 59.
Yeah.
He just turned 59. Do you, what do you guys know about Seven and Eight? Is it kind of officially announced that they are the last two, or what's the word on that?
They haven't announced that it's the last two. We think that he might sort of step down from being the guy hanging off of planes.
Okay.
You know, that maybe he could transition to being like more of the Alec Baldwin character or something.
Mm.
Or maybe just even doing less physically demanding things. But I mean, I don't think the franchise will end. Maybe this will be his last two.
Yeah, I would think he would want to. I mean, we don't know. This is pure speculation, but I would think he would want to keep producing them, whether or not he's in them in a smaller role or what. Or maybe they transition. I mean, when we started the podcast, we were talking about how it would be cool if, as he gets older, they transitioned them into a little bit more like the first movie. They were a little bit more like lo-fi spy thrillers or something, and he still did them as an older actor. But I don't, it really does kind of seem like with this 7-8 that it could be an ending of some sort, but we don't know.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's the great call right there. And I love to speculate because you know that the studio needs to make that money. I mean, Paramount is depending on this like nobody's business, but that is a great idea, is to take them. Why not? If you're going to make this many movies, why not make MI-11 a little spy thriller and make it much smaller for a small period of time? You know, it's
from the creators of Nomadland comes Mission Impossible 11.
Right. Well, we've said that there is a lot more elasticity in this franchise than I think that Paramount has given it credit for. Mm. I think you could do a lot more things and bring in a lot, you know, different tones and genre, and I think Charles and I would love to see them go back to the one director each installment, have those different points of view and those different artistic sensibilities come into the franchise.
I think another thing we talk about too that I think would be cool is if they did like a Paramount Plus miniseries or something, and just did like give Maggie Q and Paula Patton an IMF team and just do a Mission Impossible miniseries with the two of them.
Yeah,
or have like a different team each episode or something, and just do. And then there you can have different directors do 8 episodes or something, you know, and just have each one have its own kind of little mini Mission Impossible.
Charles.
It's so clear why they are able to focus on the Mission Impossible series. They're able to focus on something on their
And they
podcast.
Agree upon things. I like
you
that they agree.
See how we can't focus. We can't even focus on Tom Cruise.
Well, do you want to hear our Tom Cruise story?
Oh,
yes. God.
Jesus.
I'm trying to keep this thing on the rails because I know that we...
Good luck. Good luck.
So I don't know if you guys saw this video that Tom Cruise made last summer. where he went and saw Tenet in the theater?
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, he was. Yep.
Well, Charles and I being very bored, Charles said, let's do that. Let's remake that short, that little video when we go and see Mission Impossible for the 25th anniversary. So we made a shot for shot remake of that short film. Ooh. With me as Tom Cruise going to see Mission Impossible. And then Charles, you want to take it away? What happened after that?
We posted it and people were sharing it and they were tagging McCrory and Cruise in it. And then we heard from, should we say who we heard it from? Or
yeah, you can say who. I think we could say who we heard it from.
Well, so McCrory messaged us and said, hey, just so you know, I wonder if I should get the exact wording, but he said something like, just so you know, I shared your video with Cruise and he was in stitches.
Dudes, you guys.
That's awesome, guys.
That's a big deal, you guys. Like, that's...
it's pretty funny.
That's half the battle right there.
Yeah.
Do you guys have the love for Cruise that we do, or is it just the love for Mission Impossible?
No, we have a very strong love for Cruise.
Okay.
That maybe has predated our even discussions about Mission Impossible in this depth. He is amazing. I can't wait for him to... part of me wishes that he will kind of get the Mission Impossible stuff out of his system, so he will go back to the more kind of auteur-driven stuff.
The 90s.
Charles and I always talk about how interesting it is that he worked with all these kind of luminaries, and then he started working with more young sort of up-and-comers.
In his 40s and 50s.
Right, and giving people like J.J. Yeah.
That was the pivot point, was MI3 with J.J.
Yeah.
Because right before that, he was making movies with Spielberg and obviously Kubrick and Paul Thomas Anderson. And
we did. Yeah, he did Jerry Maguire, Eyes Wide Shut, Magnolia, all in the span of like 3 years.
And don't forget all the directors he worked with in the late 80s. Every film he worked with from Rain Man on.
Coppola. And, I mean, everybody.
Levinson. Like
Rob Reiner. I mean, it was everyone.
Neil Jordan.
Yeah. And then so MI3 was kind of the turning point where then from then on, he was kind of more of a producer and working with directors who were not on that same kind of level. It seemed like he was kind of giving himself over to them more, and then he became more creatively involved. I mean, maybe that's just my overanalyzing.
No, that's funny that you say that, because I read an article and I brought it to these two guys that somebody said that Tom Cruise has two careers. The first half is from his first movie up till MI2. MI2 is actually the turning point of the 20-year span where he goes from the dramatic rom-com, you know, call it serious actor or whatever you want that to be, that 80s and 90s Cruise, and then the 2000 to 2010s, which is the perfect, you know, 2000 is where MI2 is, where he becomes more of the action star and the producer, and you get the big, huge budgeted film. So I don't know. What do you think of that?
Yeah, that works too. Totally.
Yeah. I mean, the experience on Eyes Wide Shut, I'm sure, was creatively invigorating for a lot of reasons, but I'm sure it was just as frustrating and, you know.
Yeah.
So I feel like that was really the thing that maybe broke like serious artist Tom Cruise, although he did do Magnolia right after. So he wasn't completely.
But they shot that for 11 days.
Yeah. Right.
I think it was 11 days is the. Yeah. I mean, he literally was a guest star. He was in and out.
I think that these new relationships he has forged with people like Kaczynski, who I really admire a lot, and Doug Liman are super interesting too. That he is maybe it's also in terms of pushing himself physically. He has to kind of depend on people who he knows and trusts in a way to kind of make sure everything is buttoned up, because there is so little room for error. But I think these kind of new relations, you know, he's about to do another one. Obviously, Maverick was with Kaczynski. The space movie is with Liman.
Yeah, it's the same three.
So, yeah.
He uses these guys. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Now we've built our podcast around one day meeting Tom Cruise. And I've asked Joel and Jeff 100 times what they will do when they meet him. And the answer is some form of crying and
convulsing
and fainting and getting arrested for one thing or another. And
that's what our podcast is building towards. I mean, similar to yours. I mean, we're building towards hopefully meeting Tom Cruise and interviewing him.
Wait a second. So it's a race.
Guys, just like what's happening right now.
I guess it is a race.
With Cruise trying to get to space.
Yeah, which is great. It's a race, but we started 2 years ago.
Yeah, they started. You got a head start, but we got Jeff. I don't know what makes up for your head start.
His pathological obsession.
Well, I'll tell you this much, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart. If either one of us, I know on our end, you guys are fantastic what you do. I've listened to a few of your pods already. I really hope that you get them. I really do, because you guys run likewise. Some great interviews.
All jokes aside, seriously, yes.
You guys know what
you're
doing.
Right back at you. And I think that on both of our parts, he is a person with boundless enthusiasm, and I think he will appreciate people who have similar passion for him and his work. And
everyone has said that to us. No one has said, stay away from him, which is definitely what you could imagine many of his closer right. friends would have advised. Yeah. But everyone seems to be saying, you know, he would. And we had, Joel, tell him about Kevin Pollak. We are our closest brush with Tom Cruise is a Kevin Pollak story. And then our next closest brush will be with a man named Craig O'Brien. If you don't know who he is, we'll tell you about him in a second here. So, Joel, what happened with Kevin?
I work with Kevin on Maisel, and Kevin was gracious enough to come on and was just, you know, just gave
awesome.
Us nothing but amazing stories. But he, before he came on, he texted Cruz that he was coming on to do this, and he told me, and he let me know. He was like,
not only have I met Tom Cruise, but I am your first and only guest who texts with Tom Cruise to tell him about you.
And his response was nothing short of Cruise enthusiasm.
Cruise enthusiasm. Yeah.
We got the Cruise enthusiasm for our pod.
You know, we were like 3 or 4 months into doing these, and Cruise already, you know, knew about it. So we were
Aware of your show. That's
he's aware of our show.
Yeah, he's aware of it, and that was
that's awesome.
Really, really excited.
And
about
then
that
our Mission Impossible story, Jeff, maybe you want to tell. I don't know if you guys heard. We did an interview with someone who will be our next closest brush with Cruise and closest brush with death. Jeff?
Craig O'Brien, who was the aerial cinematographer that filmed the famous Halo sequence in MI6 and jumped out of an airplane with him 100+ times. He was like, yeah, man, why don't you guys jump out of an airplane with me and I'll film you guys doing it and we'll send it to Tom. And we said, okay. So
are you doing that?
Currently we're slated for the middle of August. And
I don't think we would do that. But I have been in a car with Wade Eastwood driving at, 120 miles an hour, which was pretty
with who?
Exciting. Wade Eastwood, who did the stunts for 5 and 6, yeah.
All right, so with that, let's end with this. Does anybody have a theory on will Ethan Hunt live or will Ethan Hunt die? Because I asked that because this whole idea started with me 10 years ago having this idea where what if Tom Cruise said, my character, this main character that I'm creating, Ethan Hunt, dies. And we were so upset. And then he was going to retire and never act again. Right. And so I lived in fear of that 10 years ago.
He made up something that didn't happen and then lived in fear of it.
I shit you not. That is exactly right. I created this weird world in my brain where this is exactly what happened. So here we are now. He's going to be 60 easily by the time these movies come out. And does Ethan Hunt live? And does Ethan Hunt continue on?
I think it's possible. It's possible that he could die at the end of 8, I guess. McQuarrie and Cruise are so in tune with what the audience wants.
Yeah.
They're very careful about that, even, you know, with all the test screenings they do. If they did that, they would have to find a way to do it where it's satisfying to an audience somehow. So I don't want that to happen, but I do know that if they do make it happen, it'll be in some amazingly satisfying way.
I don't want a definitive answer. I want to believe that maybe he's alive. I want to think he's dead, but there's a chance. So I don't want to see him die.
Let me ask a final thing. Cause we believe strongly in putting things out into the universe. We said 2 weeks ago, you know, Rosie O'Donnell would be the perfect guest for our show, and we just recorded with her. So I want to throw out, I want you guys to throw out, who other than Tom Cruise, who's your next, who's your dream guest that you have no connection to? No cheating, like you're almost there yet. Who do you have no connection to?
Who's on our Mount Rushmore, Charles?
We got De Palma, and that was huge. That was really of just absolutely insane. Awesome. It's hard to pick just one now at this point. Other than Cruise.
But if I say pick your top 7, then we know what's going to happen when I throw it to Jeff.
Don't do that.
We're just going to have to go into part 2 and part 3 here. So
I mean, I think JJ and John Woo are the two probably biggest,
right,
probably that we really want to get. We also want to get the actors. I mean, we want to get Rebecca Ferguson. We want to get Ving Rhames. We've had Simon Pegg on the show, at least in a group setting, but it would be great to have Simon Pegg in a solo.
He would be great.
Danny Elfman, Hans Zimmer. Listen, everything at this point is just pure gravy. I mean, we never thought we would do anything with this podcast.
Oh, good for you guys, man.
The fact that we've had this sort of encyclopedic, compendium of the entire franchise week by week has been really special. And every episode is just a gift that we get to do. So Yeah, we'll talk to whoever. We're excited to talk to everybody.
I like it. Joel, give one name. Who's your number one right now? Do you have a new number one?
It was just thrown out there. I just think he's so talented. A funny Simon Pegg.
We've only talked to him via Skype bomb when McCrory was giving out our Skype address for our 100th episode.
No shit. He wasn't scheduled to be there. He just showed up?
No, yeah. It was just McCrory. And then McCrory was just getting everybody to come in. So Simon Pegg came in. It was a total shock. I mean,
that's awesome.
It was crazy. Yeah, if you haven't listened to the 100th episode, it's definitely worth a listen because McCrory was just having these people, Haley Atwell Zoom bombed and composer Lauren Balfe Zoom bombed us. It was great.
That's great, you guys. That's amazing. Awesome. I'm going to just name the most impossible because it's Mission Impossible and it's a perfect tie to everything. But we do want her. I want Nicole Kidman. I listened to her on the Mark Maron podcast, and she talked in depth about Eyes Wide Shut and her experience doing it with Cruise. And all I want to do is just see her face to face and be like, I there's nothing I want to ask you about your personal life. I don't care about any of the other stuff.
Except your ex-husband. I don't want to know anything about your personal life, except can you talk for an hour about your ex-husband?
You guys, this was incredible. I can't thank you enough. This is a dream come true to be talking about Cruise with experts like you guys. So congratulations on your run.
But we are certainly as enthusiastic as you guys.
Well, you do a lot more research than Jeff and I, I'll tell you that.
Well, they do research, so.
Period.
Well, we'll talk when the trailer drops or when Top Gun comes out or something. We'll come back.
We'll be right back. All right, and that wraps up another episode of Meeting Tom Cruise. Now, there's something I wanted to bring up to Joel that Joel doesn't know that I'm bringing up to him, and that's what's so much fun about it, is during our interview with Vanessa Shaw.
I was awesome? Are you going to bring up how awesome I was?
Constantly.
Okay. Joel thought it was very cute when he and Vanessa started singing together. Specifically, they were singing the theme song, a theme song to Top Gun.
Highlight of the episode.
I want you to pay close attention to what Joel actually said while he was singing.
I went to the
danger zone.
Yes, he said, I went to the danger zone. Jeff, is that the lyrics?
No, Joel Johnstone, it's highway to the danger zone, not I went to. No, man, highway to the danger
zone. No. Hang on. I'm looking at.
He's Googling furiously, guys.
Okay. Listen up, assholes. Hang on.
I got it up in front of me.
Hang on. First of all, I like my version better. Okay. I think Kenny Loggins is going to rewrite. Okay. Second, here it is. Here it is. Second refrain, okay? Yeah. Let's analyze this, okay? Second refrain. Highway to the danger zone. I'll take you right into the danger zone. He dips into the first person. That's why I thought he's the storyteller. He's telling it from the first. Hey, I went to the danger zone. I'll take you into the danger zone.
You sound insane right now.
You're insane. My lyric is better than Kenny Loggins. If I'm giving you directions, Jeff, if I'm recalling directions, if you say, how did I get to your house? Well, I took Moore Park and then I took a right.
I'm singing a song. Joel, do you think Kenny Loggins wrote that song in order to give someone directions to a certain place they were going?
Do you think this is a song about Google Maps?
I think he's a generous man offering someplace he had been and saying to, hey, why don't I take you to someplace I've been, not someplace the highway has been.
He's just saying, I want to hurry up and fuck, right? Isn't that what that highway to the danger zone?
It is not about fucking. It's about making love, A. Also, is that really what the song's about?
In a blue light.
Isn't that what every song's about?
Guys, misunderstanding lyrics. I could spend a whole podcast on lyrics that I am positive are the ones the musician wrote down, and I am so dead wrong so often.
Instead of spending a whole podcast on it, let's spend one credit sequence, shall we?
Meeting Tom Cruise is hosted by Jeff Meacham, Joel Johnstone, and me, Alec Lev. It's also produced by the same Alec Lev.
My high school girlfriend thought that Dave Matthews was saying, hike up your shirt, little boy, and show your world to me. Not hike up your skirt a little more and show your world to me.
Our executive producers are Doug Matica and Dan Patrick. Our engineer and mixer is Alex Reeves for Point of Blue Studios.
Revved up like a deuce, another runner in the night. it sounds like wrapped up like a douche in the middle of the night. That's what it sounds like.
Editing by Alec Lev, with additional editing by Alex Reeves. On Lionel Richie's All Night Long, right, and the chorus, it's not that I thought he sang this, but I would always sing, "Lips are poppin', Bullwinkle."
I love it.
"Lips are poppin', Bullwinkle."
Our music is by H. Scott Salinas and Matthew Atticus Berger. Speaking of those guys, if you knew the name of our theme song, Joel, you would have known the real lyrics to that song. It can now be revealed to the audience. The name of our theme song is "Interstate to the Area of Peril."
"Highway to the Danger Zone."
Artwork by Rebecca Montoy.
A girl that I went to college with misheard Ruben the Sky with Diamonds.
Lucy, stop.
Lucy, you just said Ruben.
Jesus Christ. Ruben. Okay. I did know it was
Ruben
Lucy.
In the Sky with Diamonds.
I did know it was
Lucy. You see Ruben over there? He's got diamonds.
Executive produced by Paul Anderson and Nick Pinella for Workhouse Media.
Lucy and the Sky with Diamonds misheard the line, "girl with kaleidoscope eyes," but a girl in my college thought it was, "a girl with colitis goes by."
Colitis?
We are a production of Meeting So-and-So in association with Workhouse Media.
Yeah, I always thought in the Queen song, "We Will Rock You," he was saying, "kicking your cat all over the place."
Find us online at Meeting Cruise on Instagram and Twitter. Check out our website and show notes at meetingtomcruise.com. And you can email us at contact@meetingtomcruise.com. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating. 5 stars are much appreciated. And write a review. It really helps people to find the show, and we just might read it on the air. Meeting Tom Cruise was created by Jeff Meacham and Alec Lev.
It doesn't make a difference if we're naked or not.
Meeting Tom Cruise is a production of the Dan Patrick Podcast Network and iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
I went to the